Hello and welcome to the Legacy Hour podcast, where we learn from powerhouse entrepreneurs on how they intentionally built their business to leave legacies not only to their customers and employees, but also to their communities and families. I'm your host, Victoria McClossage, and I've got one question for you. We all leave a legacy, good or bad. What will yours be? On today's episode, Jesse Alexander, co-founder of 31Bits, takes us on the adventure of creating an ethically sourced jewelry brand, handcrafted by the finest artisans across the world. What started as a trip to Uganda turned into a flourishing business that has positively impacted hundreds of women's lives as they made money for their family, honed their jewelry making craft, and received an education on finances and other life skills that will impact generations to come. So without further ado, Jesse Alexander. Jesse, thank you so much for joining us here on the Legacy Hour podcast. One of the things that we like to do is get started at the beginning. So tell us where you grew up and what did you study?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Victoria. I'm super excited to be here today. And I actually grew up, I guess, in a few different places. I grew up in Illinois in a little town called Morton and lived there till I was seven. Then moved to Northern California for a few years and then settled in Bakersfield for junior high and high school. And then I'm now in Costa Mesa, where I went to university in Costa Mesa, and then I've stayed ever since. So I've been here for about 15 years now and absolutely love it. And I mentioned that I moved around a lot because I really feel like it was pretty formative in who I am now as far as just loving connecting with new people, meeting new people. I'm pretty extroverted, so I feel like I just was forced to learn how to do that growing up by being in new schools and with new groups of friends in different places. So I actually really value that part of my upbringing for sure. And I went to Vanguard University in Costa Mesa, California, where I studied cultural anthropology. And when I started there, I did not even know what anthropology was and was forced to take a class in my first semester, and I absolutely loved it. It was just the idea of studying people and culture and why people are the way they are and how their culture defines them and why they make the choices they do and things like that was just so fascinating to me. And it ended up really opening up the door for our future company, which I would have never expected, but it was a huge, huge blessing in disguise.
And is that because travel was part of learning culture?
Yeah, I had, you know, I grew up, obviously we moved around a lot and had traveled around the States growing up, but I grew up in a big family. So the idea of international travel wasn't even an option. My parents, I don't think had even at least left the continent. I mean, maybe, you know, a quick trip to Canada or something, but we really didn't do a lot of international travel, but it really fascinated me. And so I think I was kind of the first in my family to actually get on an airplane and travel abroad to Europe and Africa and places like that. And I think that for some reason, I did one mission trip in high school, fell in love with the idea of traveling. And I think that's why anthropology really was, I was so attracted to it because it just the idea of learning and setting all these places that I only dreamt of going to all of a sudden became a reality.
Yeah, I did some mission trips back in high school to Australia and South Africa. And I think having been completely opposite in my upbringing to you, where I was in the same house my entire life, and the first time I ever left was to go to college, having those summer mission trips were so eye-opening that people lived wildly different. But they themselves were pretty similar in at least the they wanted to provide for their family. They wanted to hopefully love their neighbor. Community was important. Even though we were different from a cultural perspective, who we were as humans felt connected.
Yeah, 100%. That's what you really quickly realize, that this value of family and taking care of the people that you love the most and just striving for success and striving for meaning in your life. I mean, all of those are parallels in really any culture that you interact with, at least in my experience.
And if I did my research correctly, it seems a trip to Uganda set your trajectory in a different path. Is that correct? And tell us more about that trip.
Yeah. So a few of my girlfriends in college, a few of us were all studying cultural anthropology. One of our other founders, which I'll get into, you know, studied communications. And so we had this group of girls that the other four actually besides me all went to Uganda, and not necessarily with this vision to go start a company, but knew that, you know, based on one of the girls' trips, knew that these women in Uganda were making this really cool jewelry and needed a way to support their families. And as just becoming customers themselves of these artisans and realizing, gosh, I would wear this jewelry is so fun. They brought a bunch of it back. And we really quickly realized, you know, based on our classes we were taking in anthropology and the studies we were doing on international development work, we really quickly realized, like, okay, here's these women that are making this amazing jewelry. We not only want to wear this, but we know plenty of other women that would want to wear this and buy this. And why not put the two together and give these women a way to make a sustainable income? To be honest, I was pretty skeptical at first. I had been in all of these international development classes where we were studying the negative effects of what development and what charity work had looked like over the past few decades, and how you know, so many churches and organizations were going in doing quote unquote good works or good deeds, but not recognizing maybe the negative impact of what they were doing. And I had even realized in my looking back at some of the mission trips that I had been on, not that we were having this huge damaging effect, but I had to question, what good was it to go there for 2 weeks and leave? You know, what impact did we actually have? Were we just giving handouts and just creating dependency on Western culture, or were we actually leaving something that was long-term impactful and creating long-term sustainability? And so I had a lot of fear in the idea of doing any kind of international development work, because I just was worried that we could really have some damaging effects by creating this dependency on Western culture instead of creating autonomy and independence and creating long-term sustainability for a community. And so we really spent our senior year of college kind of getting the company going, but really firmly planting ourselves in Gulu, Uganda, in the town that we were working with these women, just to really learn and understand what was happening in that culture and what does the short-term and long-term impact look like for working in this culture. And so we didn't go to Uganda, bring jewelry back and say, okay, we're off to the races. That's kind of what we got some opportunities that made it feel like it was moving rather quickly, but we really took the time with anything that we did in Uganda to make sure that we were learning as much as we could and well researching the opportunity that was there.
So tell me more about that, because it's funny that you had mentioned reflecting on what missions trips do both positively and negatively. And I was actually recently reading an article about how not even mission trips, but organizations that have really good intentions don't take the culture into account when building out the businesses, don't take into varying levels of business acumen, and they create these strategies and plans that just aren't possible in certain locations. And they have this like start-stop constant feel to them. And then they end up burning out and not making kind of a lasting change. So for any entrepreneurs who are listening, who are thinking about service within another country, what are some of those long-term plan ideas that you guys were very intentional about when building this business?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the biggest thing to keep in mind is that there's not a formula that's going to work in every culture, because every culture is so different. The resources, the talents and skills you might find, the goals and, you know, what success looks like in that community, mm-hmm. the roles of gender. I mean, there's just so many different elements that are important within a community that there can't be a perfect formula for every single community. And we've learned that even because we work in Uganda and Bali, and mm-hmm. our work in the two countries look very different from each other. And our purpose in each country looks very different from each other, because we know that what works in one place isn't necessarily the solution that another place needs. And so I think the biggest thing is spending the time with people on the ground in that community to really understand what the different elements of success would look like and what that long-term sustainability could look like and will look like. And so for us, the program that we built in Uganda, we're super, super proud of, because we can't even claim that we built it, because it was really a community effort with the women that we were working with in Uganda. And so everything that we did there was based off of our learnings, and honestly, some mistakes too, but based off of our learnings with the women that we are working directly with and addressing actual needs. So just a couple of examples, when we started working with the women, making sure that we are going to be working with them on a consistent basis, we started paying them monthly. And we realized that they were coming to us, we'd give them a paycheck, and a week later they were coming to us saying, "Hey, I've got to pay my child's school fees this week. Can I get a loan, or can I get paid in advance for next month?" And we're thinking, well, you just got paid this last week. That doesn't make sense, because that would have been plenty to cover these school fees. And what's going on? And we realized, most of us grew up in the West with some knowledge of, if you want something, you need to put money aside and save for it. Whether you're a kid saving up for a toy or a bike, or, a teenager saving for a car or whatever, you realize this idea that, you need to put money aside to save for that thing you want to purchase or that bill that you might have. And that's a learned concept. We don't think about that. Someone actually had to teach you to think like that. And if you grew up in a culture where you had no education and no parent figure to teach you something like that, it sounds silly, but literally, if we hand cash to a woman in Uganda, she's going to go out and spend it, because she's never had cash in her hand before to spend like that. So, she's thinking about what's going to go on the dinner table tonight, and, maybe get a new hair wig or get a new outfit or whatever. And it's not because she's selfish and because, she's only thinking of herself. It's just because she literally hasn't thought, she's never had the opportunity to think about next week's bills, because she's only ever been concerned about what she can afford to put on the table that night. And so there's no learning there. So fast forward, we realized this very, very quickly and early on, and we immediately put in financial trainings into our program as the first thing that happened. The first thing is, a woman comes into the program, she does get some cash up front so we can make sure that she's eating and has dinner on the table and can come to work on time and that her kids are being taken care of. But the next thing is really making sure that she understands the idea of what to do with that money when you get paid, and how to set some aside, how to budget for bills, how to think about the future, how to set goals. I mean, for most of the women, they've never had the opportunity to set a goal before for their life. That's not ever been a thing that they've been taught or known how to do. And so really teaching those basic fundamentals. And then that's really the beginning. But I mean, the list goes on and on of the types of programs that we were able to develop alongside the actual need. We realized that once we had a rather large group of women working for us, we realized that quite a few of them were just randomly not coming to work and getting sick. And, we realized that there was a good chance they were HIV positive, but weren't going, or maybe they knew that they were, but they weren't going and getting their medicines, which were rather easy to get and rather easy to treat because of all the organizations that offer those kinds of medications. Mm-hmm. But there's such a negative stigma around going and getting tested or going and getting those kinds of medications that they don't want to be seen doing that. And so we realized, gosh, this is such a treatable thing, and there's such a negative stigma that our women that we're working with aren't willing to go and do that and take advantage of it. And so we started doing private distribution and trainings and testing in our headquarters there on the weekends where women could come in privately and make an appointment. And it was just like going to their everyday work, except they were actually going to get this testing and treatment. And so that really has this ripple effect of them being able to work, which means they can mm-hmm. provide for their families, meaning their kids can go to school and so on. And so it's like this one small thing has this huge ripple effect of what the capabilities are of each person once we were able to do that. And so, again, multiple different things like that, but it really, unless you're there on the ground, spending time and actually building trusting relationships with the people that you're working with, that's, to me, that's really the only way you can learn that kind of thing is by creating first that trust. And then secondly, really understanding the need because of those relationships that you have.
I think that's a perfect example of the short-term versus the long-term strategy, right? The short-term is we want to sell, you know, jewelry or anything that you want to make and we'll send you a paycheck. But the long-term is how do we help enable you to learn and understand finances and get medical help and medical attention that you need in order to make this not only a lifelong benefit for the woman, but also she's going to pass those things on to her kids and their kids and so on and so forth. And before you know it, communities are changing and the level of education is rising. And that's where that ripple effect truly comes from.
Yes, 100%. And it's, and really for us, it was always meant to make sure that this program was temporary and that the goal is for women to graduate out of the program so that they're not dependent on 31 bits. And so we've graduated 150 women completely out of the program who are now fully self-sustainable. So we taught them, and I say we, but this is with, Ugandan, college educated, managers that were really running the program. So that was all, done in Uganda through our Ugandan mm-hmm. team. But we brought them through a program where these women are now no longer dependent on 31 bits, but have their own businesses in Uganda, helping support the local economy, giving them a long-term future, so that there was no longer about relying on, and especially, you know, we can get into this a little bit more, but the program is actually completed now. And it was, without knowing it, wonderful timing because we had actually closed out the program after, you know, all of these women had graduated back in December. We did not know that COVID would be hitting mm-hmm. soon after. We might have had been forced to do that anyway, but thankfully our women have all, you know, graduated out of this program and, about a year ago now. And, they have their own businesses. They are, self-sustainable. They're making a daily income and they've been empowered in that way by being part of 31 bits. So we're really proud of that and hope to continue, you know, recreating versions of that in other places.
Absolutely. I mean, that is just a testament to that long-term strategy. Let's take it back to, for those who don't have a clear picture of what 31 bits is, it's an accessory line that is ethically produced by artisans around the world. So you started in Uganda. Tell us about what did the operation look like when you first started? You know, 12 years ago, there wasn't Shopify to make e-commerce easy. So how did you go about even importing the jewelry or any of the items that they created, get them somewhere where they were sellable, and then start to make those transactions?
Yeah, I mean, starting 12 years ago was such an interesting time because it wasn't just pre-Shopify, but it was pre-Instagram. There was no Pinterest, there was no Etsy. I mean, I think we had Facebook and that's about it. So it was definitely, which makes me feel old, but
same.
It definitely was, it was definitely pre all of those things. I mean, I remember we were getting our first boxes of jewelry in and we had a handful of people requesting us to be able to sell online and others that were still hesitant to even use their credit card on a website. So, I mean, that tells you something, but it was, but yeah, we really started, I mean, we started definitely in a very scrappy way of just bringing suitcases of beads, beaded jewelry back from Uganda. And every time someone on our team would fly back and forth, we were literally bringing extra suitcases full of jewelry.
Oh,
so
wow.
I'm not sure how we snuck through customs that many times with that, but somehow we managed. But we started honestly just shipping jewelry. The great thing about jewelry is that it is fairly lightweight and you can fit a lot in a box. And so we were able to just ship by air using jewelry, but we were literally storing bins and bins of jewelry in our college apartments and our poor roommates who were just, you know, used to seeing beads everywhere. But in the beginning stages, it was really about just being as scrappy as we could. We were shipping through our college's mailroom. I was packing orders in the back of my car. I have lots of memories of that. So obviously starting very scrappy, very organically, but really I think the biggest growth tool that we had was just people who were excited about it. And I really think this is still, even though we have all these other tools now to market and to talk about products, I still truly, truly believe that the number one marketing tool that you have is marketing through relationships and through people who are willing to pass on your story. And so we really started through women who are willing to throw house parties and would open up their homes, invite their friends over and hear about this work that we were doing in Uganda and connecting through these house parties with women in Uganda that, and how we kind of started this whole conversation, that you realize that, wow, these are mothers with ambitions, just like I am, and mothers who want to provide for their families, just like I do. And so we were hearing these stories of how women here were able to connect to women across the world by just wearing the products that they had made. And so it was a really beautiful picture of kind of bringing this world together before social media was really as big as it is now. And it felt really special and organic. And I remember having a woman, one of our Ugandan artisans, film a little video for one of our house party hostesses to thank her. And the joy and tears that it brought this woman and her family were so special. And just to be able to form those kind of connections between two strangers was such a beautiful, beautiful picture of community. And so, there was just so many opportunities like that in the beginning. And it was really all about that really organic growth. We also did have a really cool opportunity to work with Reef Sandals, which at the time was, you know, one of the
super
biggest
cool
sandals or companies in the world. Yeah. And it was the sandal designer there. We had a mutual friend with her, and she had heard about 30 on Bits, heard about these beads that we were sourcing. All the beads, by the way, if you don't know, are made from paper. The beads from Uganda are all made from rolled paper and sealed with a varnish, which is what hardens it. You would never know they're paper until you look really closely, but they're just such a cool product. And so the designer, the sandal designer at Reef, got a hold of one of the necklaces, loved it, and said, how can I put these on a sandal? How can I put these beads on one of our leather sandals? And so she designed a few pairs that were just so fun. And we had the opportunity to work, I think our first order of strands of beads for 17,000 pairs of sandals. And so we had to figure out how to produce these, which had to be rather perfect to all fit on the right sizes of sandals. But we really had to get our quality control in gear very quickly. But it was a great opportunity. And looking back, just so thankful for the opportunity. It was much less about the money, because it was, you know, as we were just trying to really figure things out, I don't even know that it was the most profitable thing for us, but it was definitely the tipping point that made us really realize, like, we've got something here. You know, people are interested and attracted to this idea. And it really made all of us want to, and us as in there's a five of us founders. It made us all really start to realize, like, we've got something here. We need to take this seriously. And we all really made it our full-time gig. We were also working our outside jobs and students and finishing up school, but we really all committed to making sure that we were going to be able to create long-term sustainability for Uganda, which we knew was only possible by creating long-term sales and actual long-term customers here in the States. And so, yeah, that's kind of how we made it all happen in the beginning.
That's awesome. All right. Well, two starter questions that I want to make sure that we address before we get too far into the story. Several of our audience members are really at the tipping point of, hey, I have an idea. I have an idea with a friend. I want to get this started. How did you decide that you were all going to be co-founders? And what did that mean? And then secondly, how did 31 Bits get named?
Yeah, great questions. I'll start with the second question because it's a quick but kind of fun answer. My co-founder, Callie, who was kind of the one that first originally went to Uganda and discovered these beads, she named the company and was super inspired by Proverbs 31, the passage, some passages in the Bible that talk about women providing for their families using their gifts and talents. And we just thought that was such a beautiful picture of these women in Uganda and really them using their hands and their talents to make something and create something beautiful to provide for their families. And then Bits is for bits of paper, since that's what those original beads are made out of.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so that's 31 bits. Yeah. So that's how the name originated. And then as far as the founders, so Callie, after she got back from her first trip to Uganda, she had a few girlfriends come back with her and kind of start getting things going. They came home from that trip and asked me to come on as probably the one with the most type A personality of the group and just kind of help with some of the sales, marketing, stateside stuff. And so there's five of us, and it was all really because of our passion and desire to work with these women in Uganda. And it was less about working with Ugandan women and more just because of the relationships that the girls had started to build with this particular group of women. Again, it was never this mission to be like, we want to go work in Africa. Mm-hmm. It was more like, we met these women and we want to be part of what they're doing. And so it was really all built out of the relationships. And so yeah, I had the opportunity to come on alongside of them and really help get things going. And honestly, we were able to have that kind of collaboration with each other and partnership with each other, just because we realized that this is all for something much bigger. This was not ever about any of our personal success, but it was really about what is best for the artisans that we're working with and what's going to make this company thrive. I will say that I don't know that I would recommend starting a company with five people. It does make for a lot. I'll say this. I think that the downside of having so many owners is that it's hard to ever feel ownership when there's so many owners. And so there was a lot of things that I think slowed down the growth because of that, you know, not any one of us were able to take the reins and really push things forward because there was a lot of maybe checks and balances that every big decision had to go through. So it definitely slowed it down. But at the same time, I don't think I would change anything about our story because each of those girls brought something so valuable to the table. I just am so thankful for our foundation in having each of those different skills and talents from the beginning. But yeah, from the perspective of really making things move forward quicker, I would say, I think, you know, finding that one other half of you that can do the things that you can't do and vice versa is how I would recommend starting a company. But again, I am thankful for our story.
Yeah, I think that's really important to highlight that the root of everyone's philosophy was stick to the mission, not personal endeavors or not personal beliefs, but why did we start this? Which is really important because I think once you start to see success and you see income come in the door, very quickly mission can go out the window, and exponentially growing the business all of a sudden is the mission. And you started 31 Bits around jewelry, and you have started to bring it back and be in women's homes, and you have a deal with Reef Sandals. How did you then, or when in the process, did you think about online sales, and what did that look like?
Yeah, so as we're doing all of these house parties and starting to really build relationships with different women and customers, they were asking, you know, how do I continue buying this? How do I continue buying this for gifts? And you know, my sister, my friend lives across the country. How does she do this? How does she get her hands on jewelry? And so we realized rather quickly that we needed to start a website of some sort. And so but it was hard because at the time we were selling one of a kind jewelry. And so starting a website and online sales also meant creating collections of jewelry that we could sell, you know, more than one of each piece. And that's really the only way that we're ever going to be able to scale beyond selling in people's homes. And so I think we spent the first 6 months just really evangelizing our product through house parties and through craft fairs and things like that. But then quickly worked with a guy at our college who was into building websites, and he built us one for free, which we're very grateful for. And so we started really figuring out then how can we create collections of jewelry, and we started working with different vendors in Uganda where we could support vendors who would sell us paper. And so I remember being in Uganda and driving to different headquarters for cell phone companies and for soft drinks and things like that, and asking, do you have any old marketing posters that you don't need anymore? And it was like the cell phone company that was most popular had this like bright yellow branding. And so we had a lot of bright yellow jewelry that year. And so that was kind of the beginning stages of figuring out. And eventually we figured out how to take that, you know, recycled paper and go to printers and get different Pantone colors and made things a lot more fashionable and, you know, really focused on the fashion side of and trend side of it. But yeah, in those beginning stages, it was, you know, little by little realizing, okay, to make a collection, we need to have all of the same color paper, and that this is how we're going to do it. And so it was really just using the resources that we had. With that said, I would say we also always valued the fashion side. So, thankfully it was a time when bright colored jewelry actually was very trendy. And so I think we kind of lucked out with that. But we were able to really use a lot of those vibrant colors to create some actually really cool fashionable pieces. And so, again, we equally knew that the only way that this was going to work in Uganda and have that long-term sustainability is by making sure that we can develop a product that people actually want to buy. It's not just because it's a one-time charity buy, but it's actually, they're picking this necklace up first because they like it and they think it's really cute and it's something that they want to buy. And then the story behind it is the added bonus that they get to buy something that was ethically made and is actually having a positive impact in the world.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, because I remember hearing in one of my marketing classes in college that especially for organizations or companies who have that added benefit of helping others, whatever it may be, should never be the selling point, which always felt weird to me, because that's the thing that you gravitate towards most and that's the thing that gets you to buy. But it's because the product is so amazing that sitting next to its competitor, you would have already purchased that brand. And on top of it, you get to support women in Uganda or give, you know, a second set of jewelry to a woman who needs it, or so on and so forth.
Exactly.
Okay. So how did you go from selling jewelry and finding ways to sell online to thinking about the programs in it of itself for the women and the artisans making the jewelry?
The quick background of the time that we came into working in Uganda was following a war that had happened for over two decades that really left northern Uganda extremely let's just say there was very little opportunity. Many, many people had been forced to live in refugee camps, in IDP camps, which stands for internally displaced people. And they were finally allowed to leave these IDP camps, but there was nowhere to go. And there was no place for them to get a job and to make any money. And so most of our women, if they worked, they, I always feel like it sounds weird to say our women, but our artisans that we were working with, they were, you know, carrying water for delivering water to people, walking miles and miles and miles to make literally pocket change, to just go bring water to construction workers and things like that. And that was the types of work that they were doing that was so strenuous and so hard on them, and it would take their entire days, and they were not even making enough to put dinner on the table that night. And so it was extremely challenging for people to find work and to find opportunities. We knew that there could be a future, a near future in making a business out of this, but we knew long-term that what if we can't sell this jewelry at some point? We need to make sure that we're creating a program that is going to bring sustainability to these women. And so we just wanted to make sure that we were going to, if we ever had to leave Uganda, that the impact we left would be more positive than it would be negative. And so it was always the intention to make sure that we were going to be leaving with a positive long-term impact rather than a negative dependency.
Tell us about a mistake. And the reason I ask is, I think we, especially in the social environment we live in now, we see a lot of what looks like success. And, you know, I think there are certain findings that we can get from people's success stories, but I think we learn so much more from people's mistakes. Is there a time where something fell flat or you made the wrong choice as a company that you learned from or pivoted from?
That's a great question. I think that, you know, we started this business again 12 years ago, which was just an interesting time because, like I said, it was pre-social media, but it was also in a time where people were shopping very, very differently than they do now. You know, we were selling in small boutiques across the country, but also had a huge goal to sell with big box retailers. And we fortunately did. We had some really great opportunities to work with companies like QVC and Stitch Fix. And we worked a little bit with Nordstrom and a little bit with Anthropologie and a little bit with Macy's. And so we had these really great opportunities to work with some of the biggest names that are out there. But in the midst of doing that, we saw pretty early on that the future of shopping was changing, and it was changing quickly. But the problem was is that these orders from these companies were so large that we had to design our entire program and how we operated year to year and how we used our budget was around these large orders from large companies rather than direct-to-consumer sales. And I say this because I think a lot of people have this dream to work with a lot of those bigger names and a lot of those great wholesale accounts. And we're so thankful for our partnerships. I will never take that for granted because of the belief that so many of these buyers and these stores had in our little company, but they weren't dependable and they weren't sustainable for us to rely on. You know, what Nordstrom orders one year may not be what they order the next year. And so we were creating and evolving our company around these large orders and these large customers rather than thinking about our individual customers who could be repeat customers. And I think the hard part is we saw it coming, but we had already kind of created this dependency on these big orders that it was really hard for us to pivot from focusing on wholesale to focusing on direct to consumer sales. And so some of the advice that I give anyone that I consult is to start with your direct to consumer customer. If you are offering a product or service that is going straight to a customer, not to a business, then focus on the individual. Focus on how you're going to retain a customer, how you're going to get those repeat orders, how you're going to create those personalized experiences and relationships. Because if you lose a handful of individual customers, it's not going to have a huge impact on your business. If mm-hmm. you lose a handful of wholesale customers, it's going to have a huge impact on your business. And so for us, it was really, I wish we would have put all of the investment that we put into wholesale and the trade shows and all of those things into just our website and creating customized experiences. I think our growth would have been slower in the forefront and grown exponentially in the following years. And so I wish that we would have been willing to take that risk in the beginning to really put our investment and focus on directly to our individual consumers. And I think that if you do that, the big box retailer opportunities will come to you rather than you having to seek them out. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the continuing to be the future of sales is by building brand loyalty and community.
I 100% agree. I think though, to give you guys credit, nobody I think anticipated just how fast e-commerce took off. You know, the brick and mortar stores saw rapid decline in folks walking in the door to purchase something in person. And, you know, I work full time for a logistics company. And even in this COVID experience, the companies that have a footprint in both brick and mortar and e-commerce have been able to pivot in a wide variety of ways. That I don't know the folks who are just e-commerce have been able to have. So I think that the learning from the big box retailers were, you know, if your goal is to sell product and sell the most possible and not really mind if the mission of your business changes from creating a one-of-a-kind piece, if that is your mission is to sell the most possible, then that is the track to go. But if your goal is to create customer retention and create a relationship with your customer base, then potentially big box retailers aren't the answer to that question. And e-com needs to be the focus.
Exactly. Because when you get that opportunity to develop that connection and that relationship with a customer, then they're going to be your biggest marketing asset. They're mm-hmm. going to be the ones who are telling their friends about it, who are buying your product as gifts, who are wanting to be an evangelist for what you're doing. Where when you're selling through a big box retailer, I don't ever get to talk to the end customer. Right. They do, and they might be able to retain that person as a customer, but I don't get a say over how the story is told, what that customer mm-hmm. is hearing, how they're being treated. And so to really create that brand loyalty and give them the best experience, I need to own that relationship.
So from an impact perspective, give us some idea of the number of women who have gone through programs both in Uganda and Bali and the kind of impact you're having in those areas.
Yeah, so our program in Uganda was about 11 years total that we were able to bring 150 women through the program that had been through a 4 to 5 year program. In that part was, they went through financial training, health education classes, were tested for HIV and if needed, given the appropriate medications through our partnerships with local organizations. They had counseling opportunities for the men and kids in their family to come in for different mm-hmm. types of trainings and family programs, which was really exciting. And then they had an opportunity to go through business development classes and a business mentorship where they were able to identify the skills and talents that they have and the resources that they have access to and learn how to start their own businesses and really different types of businesses that would not only complement their access to resources and talents that they had, but also things that the local economy needed and that would thrive in the local economy. You know, if we had 150 women all starting businesses selling chicken, then it probably wouldn't be successful. And so really diversifying the 31 bits portfolio, if you will. But yes, we really had an opportunity to invest in each woman on a very individual basis and bring them through those mentorships. So 150 women graduated out of the program. And then in Bali, we actually work with a really great little workshop. There's a man that we got connected to early on named Ignatius. Believe it or not, we met him through Etsy. He was selling some jewelry that his artisans were making. He's a Balinese man, and he just was really like-minded in providing just an ethical workplace for artisans. And he had about 4 artisans at the time when we met him, and he's actually been able to triple his staff size over the last few years by his partnership with 31 Bits. And he works with other companies as well, but we've been able to be part of tripling his staff size because of the just great orders that have come about. And so that's been a really amazing partnership, and finding a partner on the ground in Bali that is so like-minded in providing this type of work where artisans are free to leave and go visit their families and, you know, actually celebrate their religious holidays and be paid fairly and have the proper safety equipment and all of those things. And so we're just very honored to be able to work with him and be part of his business and growing his internal company. And so we hope to continue to see that grow, especially because right now it's where the majority of our products are being sourced. And we continue to do a lot of research in other places, and hopefully you'll see some new product lines and artisan groups on the horizon with 31 Bits, which can't share anything about yet. But I think that there's going to be a lot of opportunity for really continuing to grow the global presence of the company.
That's really exciting. It's exciting to see that you guys are potentially, hopefully, fingers crossed, moving into other areas to impact even more communities. We have some entrepreneurs who listen to this podcast who are in the product space. And one of the questions we get often is, when do I move kind of out of my mom's basement or my parents' living room, fulfilling boxes, to an actual fulfillment center where we actually have, you know, labels or the same boxes to use or whatever it is? How did 31 Bits go from packing in college dorm rooms to a fulfillment center? And what does that look like today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, we really tried to keep our overhead as low as possible for as long as we could. And so we actually did most of the fulfillment on our own. Obviously, at some point we had our full-time person doing fulfillment. And but we did that because for us, it was so important to ensure quality as part of our program, because all of our products were handmade. We really wanted to be hands-on with the fulfillment. As we've grown, now we're working with a fulfillment center because we've really developed our quality control program. But I think the biggest things are asking yourself, what's going to grow my business? What's going to take me to the next level? And, you know, if packing orders and ordering supplies, if those are the biggest hindrances of keeping you from growing your business, then outsource the things that you can outsource, but make sure to include that in your bottom line. Make sure to put the price, because working with a fulfillment center is expensive. Getting customized packaging is expensive, but making sure that you include that in the prices of your product as needed. We did try to take out as much of the middleman steps as we could and be that direct to consumer resource. But at some point, to really grow the business and to get it into the hands of customers, you have to include all of that in your price and in your bottom line to make sure that you're actually going to create something profitable. And you don't have to feel bad about doing it, because the only way that you're going to succeed and the only way to make your business profitable, I think really, you know, pricing things out based on the big picture and what you want to be bringing in annually as a company and what you want to be able to sell things for. I think all of that is so important to look at. So I, even if you're not selling in a fulfillment center yet, I would start pricing it out and start moving your pricing and the choices that you're making as a company in the direction that you need to fit that criteria.
Yeah, I think if I had a message to take away from this episode, it would be, as an audience member, to think about what you're purchasing. And as you're purchasing that shirt for $4.99 or the necklace for $9.99, you have to start thinking about, you know, what is the profit that the company is making and what is the dollar amount or probably less than dollar that the person who made it is getting. And for me, you know, I've seen one too many documentaries just about how little the person making it is actually receiving. And when I see those, you know, $4.99 shirts, I just can't believe that you can fit logistics in, the cost of the material, the shipping, the paying the owner of the factory, the person who made it, paying the company for, you know, $4.99, $99. It's just, and paying them well, at least.
Yes. So, I mean, it's someone, when you see a price tag that's that low, somewhere in the supply chain has to be getting the low end of the, you know, the margin there. Yep. And it is going to always be the person at the bottom. And it is, and that's really what we set out to do as a company, is to change that and to start with that person, to start by saying, what is the fair price for this product? Like, well, how long does this take? Looking at every part of the supply chain process and saying, what goes into this? And we're not going to cut out a single part of it. And you know what? You can go to many other places and buy jewelry for much cheaper than what we're charging. But again, somewhere along the line, someone is paying the price for that purchase. And so I would much rather own less products that I know are fairly made than have my closet filled with products that so many people out there had to pay for me. And for me, it's just really about creating an ethical wardrobe. And I know it's expensive. I know that shopping ethically can be really, really challenging, especially if we're trying to shop for your kids or, you know, for yourself or for gifts or whatever it might be. But I mean, there's so many creative ways out there to shop ethically, to, you know, start considering buying less, buying used, trading. I mean, there's just so many different things that you can do to create an ethical wardrobe. And you don't have to be perfect at it, but I think if everyone makes steps toward that direction, and starts, you know, really focusing on where their products come from, if everyone even cut out 10% of their fast fashion wardrobe, think of the changes that would make. And so I really would encourage people to start taking a second look at where their products come from and what they can do to be part of demanding that things are paid for fairly.
Absolutely. All right. That is the perfect segue to take us into 2020 at 31 Bits. I definitely want to highlight the acquisition that happened in 2020. Because for some, entering into the business, acquisition is the goal from the very beginning. Some of it is halfway through, and some of it you don't know you want to be acquired until you get the call. So tell us what led up to that conversation and how, as founders, did you talk about it? Were you looking to be acquired? Did it come to your doorstep? How did that happen?
It's a great question. Honestly, the whole conversation, it was a long time coming. I mean, we had been working in Uganda for almost 12 years. We were about to graduate our final group of women. And so we were kind of at a turning point of saying, what is next? I mean, we can hire more women in Uganda and continue to sell paper jewelry, although the market was getting smaller and smaller for that specific type of product. Mm-hmm. We were, at this point, it was just one of my co-founders, Callie, and I, that were really part of the company and our small team. And Callie has two kids. I was looking at just some different opportunities for my personal career. And so we're at this turning point where we really need to decide, are we going to push this forward and be all in, or is this an opportunity, you know, after we graduate this final group of women in Uganda, is there an opportunity to do something new? And so we really started praying about it and thinking about it and realized that if we were going to take this step, it had to be now. And so we started putting some feelers out for, you know, is it possible to sell this company? Obviously, it's a handmade product. We weren't sure if, you know, an acquisition group was going to buy into that idea. Mm-hmm. And so we were just really thinking about it and praying about it at the end of 2019. And I had lined up a meeting with a marketing agency for early 2020. And the meeting honestly didn't have a big purpose. I just heard about this group that was an awesome marketing group, and I didn't know if I was meeting with them for a new job for myself or for an opportunity to see what they could do with 31 Bits and see if they could help us market. I really just was like, I've heard such great things about this group. I'm going to get a meeting with this guy. And so it was more networking than anything. And I met with one of the founders of this marketing group named Taylor, and I'm telling him kind of our journey with 31 Bits and that we were at this kind of turning point and trying to figure out what was next. And he's like, do you know that we're more than a marketing agency? I'm like, no, tell me more. And he says, well, we have this other kind of sister company called 4x400 that buys small businesses, small e-com businesses, and grows them and tries to invest into them and really grow them using the resources from the branding agency. And so, or kind of utilizing the things that they know because of the branding agency. And so after just a ton of meetings in early 2020, we really got to know the three guys that started 4x400 together, and all of them were just completely like-minded. All of them really understood the journey of founders and small businesses and working with startups, and all of them really cared. They all had similar faith backgrounds where for them it was really about, doing things for the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. All of us are Christians, and so that was a big part of our story. And so it was just really cool to see these three guys who, to be honest, knew nothing about jewelry, but they definitely were like-minded in the sense of, if we're going to do business and make money, then we want to do it for good. And we want to see really cool things come out of it. One of their other brands is actually a clean beauty brand called Bamboo Earth. And,
oh, cool.
And so we saw them working with, other products that were, somewhat like-minded and really cared about how they were made and where the products were being sourced. And so we, after a series of meeting, really felt this, just really similar vision for what could happen within 31 Bits. And so we said, you know what, this is our opportunity to see what someone else can do with what we built. And it wasn't easy to give up our baby, but we also knew that, maybe some fresh vision, and a group of people who had the money to invest into the direct to consumer side of things, mm-hmm. into our website and into online advertising. We wanted to see what they could do with it. And so we decided to move forward with the acquisition in May, and Callie and I both get the privilege of still owning 10% and being on the board and working really closely with the vision for the company. But we've been just really thankful to have a group that was willing to take the reins and really, invest heavily into the bigger vision. And we knew that, this could, even though this is hard to give something up that we mm-hmm. feel like we've literally dedicated the last decade of our life to, we figured, if they can, in the long run, be part of even more artisans jewelry and really expanding the idea of ethical fashion beyond what we ever could, why wouldn't we take advantage of that? And so, they took the reins in a very difficult time, right in the middle of a global pandemic. And so, they had a lot of challenges to get through with that. And, so I am thankful that they were willing to take such a risk in such an uncertain time, but I'm so thankful that they were willing to do that. And I'm really, really excited to see where they take it next. They just launched back in November, December, launched a really great line of new products. They have an entire line around Proverbs 31, really bringing our mission into play, and have continued to develop just some really beautiful, fashionable products. Callie, my co-founder, is still doing a lot of design work for them. So still very inspired from kind of the roots of where 31 Bits started, and just there's some really, really beautiful products. So I definitely encourage you to go check it out on 31bits.com because I've been extremely impressed with just the direction that they're taking the company.
That's really exciting. And it's so encouraging to hear of an acquisition where a mission stayed true to the acquirer, because I think so often it's about making more money and all of a sudden mission goes out the window, and why you and your four original co-founders started the business doesn't translate to them. So it's great to see that not only is this industry creating brands that are ethically sourced and paying the artisan the right dollar amount, but even the investor relationship and investor industry is changing, and that is important to the mission. Let's segue, because you are one of our first guests to kind of have a second life, right? And you are letting go of a baby in a way, still 10% owner, but and has, you know, active decision making, but still yet letting that go and venturing into what is Jesse's second life.
Yep. So I work through an agency in a full-time position at Microsoft. The agency is called Jeffrey M. They do employment for quite a few different large companies, but I work specifically 100% on a Microsoft project in their Microsoft for Startups program. And it's a really, really exciting opportunity because I get to work with startup tech companies who built their applications on Microsoft's cloud Azure. And it's all different types of startup tech, but all B2B. And I specifically work in the retail vertical. And so I get an opportunity to use so much of my past experience working in retail and working in a startup setting, and get to apply that to the tech world now, which is something I never thought I would do. I didn't think I would be in the tech world, but I have weirdly really grown to love it. So I've been in this position since around the time that the acquisition took place of 31bits, and this door opened up to work at Microsoft, and it's a really, really exciting program.
Out of sheer curiosity, what was that like going from CEO, co-founder to one of many in the Microsoft family?
Great question. It was definitely a huge transition, but I have to say that I have really loved it. And I've been very, very thankful for the opportunity. I will attribute a lot of that to working for a couple of really great bosses at Microsoft who have just really invested into me and have been really great leaders. And eventually I hope to own my own business again one day and hopefully be just even better at it because of my experience at Microsoft. So I'm very, very thankful, and it's been a great opportunity so far.
Well, congratulations. It's a huge feat to have walked right out of college, right into your first job that you own, and to literally be running from that day forward until May of this year. And I have to imagine there was a bit of a mixed feeling of a sigh of relief, but also of a pain in letting something that you've built for 12 years go, at least into somebody else's hands. And I'm really excited for you for your role at Microsoft, and Microsoft is lucky to have a business owner like you helping their startups make the best steps forward. So our last three questions are always the same for every guest, and it starts a little fluffy and it gets more to the heart, we'll say. So the first question is, tell me something you're loving. It can be something as simple as a book or a TV show or a food or a philosophy. Tell me something you're loving.
I have been loving the time that I have back on weekends and evenings. So I will say the benefit of working for the corporate world, at least in my current position, is that, you know, I can give it 110% during the day, and I am not on my computer until midnight anymore. And so I'm very thankful for the time I have back. But the bigger thing is the time that I have with family and friends. Mm-hmm. So obviously during a pandemic, that's been, you know, not quite the same, but I have had just the opportunity to host friends and cook and, you know, spend time just doing the things that I really value outside of working.
Yeah, I think the pandemic has definitely taught us about priorities, to say the least.
Yes, definitely.
All right. If you could go back to Jesse at last year of college and tell her something, what would it be?
Oh, good question. Yeah, I would say, don't stress about the small things and just really understanding how every challenge is going to make you better at what you do, that the experiences that you have are all going to prepare you for something bigger. Don't let those little roadblocks control your week and what you're set out to do.
That's very important. All right, last question, best question. What will they say about Jesse and her legacy?
I think my biggest goal is to be part of other people's legacies. And I don't mean that in this like humble brag type of way, but to me, I really hope that my legacy and what I leave behind is pushing other people forward. So whether that is the women in Uganda that I very like humbly got to be part of their stories, or whether it's startups that I'm now working with at Microsoft, or whether it's employees that I had the privilege of leading at 31bits, I really hope that anyone that I work with never felt like I was trying to bring them down or put my ideas first or trying to be the one that took credit for something. But I really, truly hope that anyone that I work with feels that I helped lead them to the place where they needed to go to be the best version of themselves, or brought them to a place where they could be more successful because of our partnership and working together. So I don't know that I've always done that perfectly, but it's really what I hope to strive for and to leave behind, is just really being part of other people's stories and pushing them forward and helping them use their gifts and talents to the best of their ability.
Well, that is the perfect inspiration to end this episode. Jesse, I could not be more grateful for the time that you've given us and the deep knowledge and expertise that you've shared with us. I am so excited for you, for your job at Microsoft. And if there's anything we can do here on the Legacy Hour, please let us know.
Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you for joining us today. If you are loving the show, can you help us get it to more people by rating the show and leaving a review on your podcast app? I'm grateful for your support. And as always, all things Legacy Hour can be found at victoriamclausage.com.